From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Robert Downey Jr. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his performance in Chaplin. He also starred in Wonder Boys and Natural Born Killers. Now he's moved from in front of the camera to behind the mic. He's got a new CD, The Futurist, featuring songs he wrote and performs. Also, filmmaker Guy Madden. He's known for his strange, silent, filmy films, like Tales from Gimli Hospital and Careful. His most recent work, The Saddest Music in the World, is now out on DVD. And film critic David Edelstein soaks up the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. On Capitol Hill today, House and Senate negotiators have been behind locked doors, haggling over legislation to overhaul U.S. intelligence efforts. As NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports, time has almost run out.
For weeks, negotiators have been deadlocked on one key point: how much budgetary control a new national intelligence director should have. That point, though, appears to have been resolved. Congressional sources say both sides gave ground. The sticking point now, ironically, has little to do with the issue of intelligence reform. Congressional aides say their bosses are arguing over provisions in the House version to do with immigration and driver's license standards. Lawmakers are expected to recess this weekend or early next week at the latest, and there are few signs this latest stalemate will be overcome. One aide to the negotiators says, barring a miracle, intelligence reform this year is all but dead. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
Iraqi forces raided an important Sunni mosque in Baghdad today. Witnesses said that 3 people were killed and 5 injured in the raid, which took place after Friday prayers. Some 40 people were arrested. U.S. troops supported the raid by sealing off the area around the mosque before Iraqi police entered. Sunni Muslim clerics at the mosque have a history of calling for attacks against the U.S.-led force. The raid came a day after Iraq's interim government warned that it will arrest and try Islamic clerics for participating in terrorism if they're found to be inciting violence. President Bush has arrived in Santiago, Chile, where he'll attend the annual APEC Economic Summit with 20 other leaders of Pacific Rim nations. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Santiago.
This is the president's first trip overseas since his re-election, and the other leaders here, some of whom opposed the war in Iraq, will be watching for clues as to whether there will be any change in tone or approach in Mr. Bush's foreign policy. There have been large anti-Bush protests here in Santiago. Tens of thousands marched peacefully through the downtown area, but there were also some violent clashes between police and a very small group of protesters who threw rocks and Molotov cocktails. Much of the discussion between President Bush and other leaders will deal with the nuclear threat posed by North Korea as the president tries to build more international support for a multinational effort to get the communist nation to end its nuclear weapons programs. Don Gagne, NPR News, Santiago, Chile.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 115 points to close at 10,457 in heavy trading. Declines outnumbered gainers by a margin of 5-2. The Dow was down 82 points for the week. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 33 points to close at 2070. This is NPR News. Diplomats at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna accuse Iran of preparing large amounts of uranium for enrichment, a process that can be used to make nuclear arms. This comes only days before Iran promised to freeze all such activities. Eugen Freund reports from Vienna.
According to sources at the IAEA, Iran is producing uranium hexafluoride. In an advanced stage, this product can then be used in both nuclear weapons and power plants. Under a deal that Iran closed last week with members of the European Union, the country had agreed to stop enrichment activities by November 22nd. Technically, Iran is not violating the accord, but the latest revelation is bound to deepen suspicions over the true intent of its atomic program. Tehran's top nuclear negotiator adamantly denied the accusation, calling it a sheer lie. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell had only 2 days ago argued that Iran was actively working on a program to enable its missiles to carry nuclear bombs. For NPR News, I'm Eugen Freund in Vienna.
A federal bankruptcy judge said today that United Airlines and its unions have until early January to reach agreement on a new set of wage and benefit concessions. If the two sides can't come to terms voluntarily, the judge said, he'll consider the airline's request to cancel its union contracts. Unions have already agreed to some $2.5 billion in givebacks, but the airline says it must cut further in order to attract new financing. United says it must trim costs by another $2 billion a year, including about $725 million in additional labor concessions. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 13 to close at 1170. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Keen, helping clients manage business performance through application outsourcing, business process outsourcing, and global delivery. Keen, we get IT done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. And this is the actor and also singer, Robert Downey Jr.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through for you. With gladness, hide every trace of sadness, although a tear may be ever so near. That's the time you must keep on trying. Smile. What's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just...
Robert Downey Jr. singing Smile, a song written by Charlie Chaplin, whom Downey portrayed in a terrific 1992 movie biography. The song, which features Charlie Hayden on bass and Alan Broadbent on piano, is from Downey's first CD showcasing him as a singer-songwriter. It's called The Futurist and will be released next week. Downey has sung and recorded before, including on a couple of Ally McBeal soundtracks, but he's made his mark as an actor, one with a troubled history of substance abuse. In addition to Chaplin, Downey's films include Less Than Zero, Natural Born Killers, Shortcuts, Wonder Boys, Bowfinger, and Gothica. Terry spoke to Robert Downey Jr. last year when the movie adaptation of The Singing Detective was released in theaters. It was a time when Downey, after long bouts with substance abuse and losing such redemptive jobs as his dynamic role on Ally McBeal, was proudly sober.
You always strike me as a really brave actor, someone really willing to take risks. And a lot of the personalities that you've played in your films are those really edgy personalities, people who are obsessive, or they're liars, or they're just, they're kind of over the top in some way or the other. Mm-hmm. And the roles that I think of, the movies I think of there are Pickup Artist, Two Girls and a Guy, Wonder Boys. I just think it's so much fun watching you.
Oh,
on screen. There's a scene, God, I forget what the song is, but there's a scene in Two Girls and a Guy, which is a James Toback film, in which you're basically lying to everybody in your life in that movie. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where you break out into song, and I'm forgetting what the song is.
Oh, Jackie Robinson's You Don't Know Me?
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about that scene a little bit?
Oh, yeah, he's, he goes into his apartment, the two gals.
This is it, yeah.
Philandering or hiding in the loft closet. And he gets home and he calls both of them on the telephone and tells them they're the only one. And you know, we know that that's about to blow up. But he's still thinking everything's cool. And he goes over to his piano microphone and sings to himself in kind of a less than serious way.
Why don't we hear that part of the scene?
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me? No, you don't know me. No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night, afraid and shy. Honey, I let my chance go by, the chance you might have loved me too. You give your hand to me, and then you say goodbye.
It's a really fun scene, I have to say. And you've been singing more since then. You sang on Ally McBeal. You sing the final song in The Singing Detective, even though your character is lip-syncing in the credit sequence at the end. You're actually singing. Do you like to sing?
I've always liked it, and I always encourage people to say, I can't really sing. I go, you know what? It's fundamentally impossible for the human body to not be able to produce, hold, carry, and interact in complex ways with tones and music and all that stuff. It's our nature. 3.5 billion years of DNA saying sing.
So what do you most like to sing?
I've composed stuff since I was 17.
Really?
I have a big stockpile of stuff. Again, you know, here's my fear. You know, I'm confident about my work. I know it's good. I just wouldn't want to release it as a lark. I would want to really, really. And I was with Sting in Chicago just a day or two ago and went and saw him in Grant Park for a big fundraiser for Save the Music. And, you know, he will sell no wine before it's time. And so, you know, I kind of am cautioned against just doing that, you know, instant gratification. Let me put out some of the stuff I've written, you know. I'm told I'm kind of a perfectionist in my work as an actor, and it doesn't even hold a candle to how I feel about music.
Robert Downey Jr. speaking with Terry Gross last year. He has a new CD out, his first, and here he is performing one of his original compositions. The song is called Man Like Me.
This is a night I've been dreaming of forever. The mirror takes a look at my face. I'll never set foot in that rat hole again, but I'll drive to your place. I spit gravel as I back out of the back door, and the 20s roll around in my hand. It's funny now when I don't show up on Monday, they're gone nuts and eat their hats. Well, what do you think of that? She says you're throwing life away to move with a man like me. She's not blind, she just don't have a mind to see. This is a habit I'm breaking now forever. I'm weary from trying to shake it. So when I ask if you won't give me your hand, I take it right now from your mother's.
town. She says you're throwing life away to move with a man like me. She's not blind, she just don't have a mind to see.
Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with Robert Downey Jr.
So how old were you when you got your first agent?
I was doing a play at the Colonnades across from the Public Theater when I wasn't bussing tables at the Central Falls right down the street on West Broadway. And I was in a play called Fraternity about SMU. And someone came to see one of the other actors in it who wound up having an interesting career himself. And they asked if they could talk to me and said that they'd be interested in signing me. And the funny thing was, I really was working as hard as I could when I did that little play, and I didn't expect much out of it. But I'd get there an hour and a half before curtain, and I'd do, I was like 16 or 17, I would do yoga, and I would run over the scenes, and I would go out and touch the lights, and, you know, all this kind of really ethereal approach to doing a little like 60-seat theater who gives a damn play, you know, but I needed that and I ritualized it. And it's funny, you know, it's almost like I never have worked as hard since in a certain fashion as I did right at the very, 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 very beginning in theater.
Who were you hoping to become? Was there an actor or a certain type of actor that you think you were modeling yourself on?
Let's see. Later on, when I was already up and running, Sean Penn was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I was hugely affected by Matt Dillon, Ralph Macchio,
mm-hmm.
Scott Baio. You know, all the guys who seemed like, wow, look at him go. And then when I got out to California, the whole Brat Pack thing was already sealed up and rolling, and I thought they were all amazing.
What about older films? Did you watch a lot of older films when you were getting started?
Well, let me put it this way. I remember my dad bringing me to see, like, Slaughterhouse-Five and Le Grand Bouffe and Truffaut movies. And I mean, it's amazing the things that I saw before I was 10 years old.
Wait, isn't the Grand Bouffe the movie where they eat themselves to death? Is that Le Grand Bouffe?
Exactly. Wasn't that great?
Oh, I hated that film.
It was awful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember the scene where the couple was making love and someone's knocking at the door and the guy says, I'm coming. And I was like, why is that funny? God, I don't get anything. And then as often as not, we'd be watching other movies and my dad would just stand up and say, we're gone. I'd be like, why? He goes, oh, this thing's scuffed. And we didn't even make it through the opening credits. He like didn't like the visual and we were splitting.
Well, that might have been helpful, though. Was he always pointing out these things that you never would have noticed as a child if you didn't have a filmmaker father to point them out?
Sure. And but aside from that, I was given a very, very specific education. You know, I mean, Preston Sturges was, you know, we named our Yorkshire Terrier after him. Kubrick, as I said before, that was our cat. You know, I mean, it was like everything was about great directors in our household and writers.
Robert Downey Jr. speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with actor and now singer-songwriter Robert Downey Jr. He made his acting debut at the age of 5 in the 1970 film Pound, which was written by his father. Actor-director Robert Downey Sr. was a filmmaker with a definite rebel streak. He directed the films Greaser's Palace, Hugo Pool, and the 1969 classic satire Putney Swope about a washed-up all-white advertising company that has transformed into the all-black radical Truth and Soul agency. Here's a scene from the beginning of Putney Swope, before the ad agency gets hip. They're working up a new product campaign.
Gentlemen, I'd like you to meet Dr. Alvin Weasley. Dr. Weasley is one of the most respected motivational researchers in the country. Harvey's beer has dropped 84%. So Dr. Weasley will tell us how the American public really feels about beer. Dr. Weasley.
Beer is for men who doubt their masculinity. That's why it's so popular at sporting events and poker games. On a superficial level, a glass of beer is a cool, soothing beverage. But in reality, a glass of beer is peepee dicky. That's it.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Pee-pee Dickie.
We paid for that?
$28,000, and we got off easy.
Your father was a filmmaker. What did you think of, like, movie making as a life?
I didn't think of anything else as a life. I mean, I knew I had friends whose fathers were doctors or worked down at, the sporting goods store, which is great because I wanted a BB gun. You know, I mean, it was like... It just seemed like, and I have to credit my folks with this, you know, it was a very organic approach to something technical, artistic, and kind of otherworldly. And then my mother is a very, very gifted actress and singer and comedian. And my father was primarily a writer who decided that he should direct what he wrote to kind of keep it true to his original intent. And it's an amazing director, very influential director. And, but more importantly than that was I had this sense of if you wanted to do something that seemed like only a small percentage of people on Earth were chosen to do that, you could do whatever you wanted. My dad always says this. He goes, anybody can act. Hardly anybody can direct. And nobody can write. So in descending order, I'm kind of in, you know, I get the bronze medal. You know, but
your father, Robert Downey, is most famous for his film Putney Swope, which was a comedy about the advertising industry and about race. What impact did it have on your life when that film became popular? How old were you then?
I was 3 or 4 when it came out. I think what it was is there was a huge reaction to it, particularly from, you know, the 10 or 12 guys, you know, that are my dad's age who've really kind of formed the artistic element of Maverick filmmaking since. And so he was very much revered and hailed as this just, you know, super innovative guy. And so the only impact it really had on me was I knew that my dad was something really, really, really special.
Was there a lot of structure in your life when you were growing up?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there was a structure. There was a structure, all right. Kind of like, that's how complexes are created, out of structures.
was there like discipline and structure, or were you pretty free to do whatever?
I went to school, you know. Went to school. I was in judo. I was in chorus. I was in drama. And that's all I got.
You dropped out of school at the age of 17, right?
Yes, gladly.
Right.
Things had gotten to the point where mom and dad split up. Dad's going back east. He said, you can stay or you can go. And then he left. And I was like, why am I staying with a buddy of mine from high school in a garage in the Venice Canals? I got to get out of here. I got to go to New York. So I went back to New York where I was from. And then I started working in theater and kind of put a little career together. And I couldn't have done both. I couldn't have finished out the school year, waited till summertime, and then gone back east. I wouldn't have made it. I didn't have any dough. I had a job at Thrifty's, but all of us got fired because 2 of us were stealing. And, you know, it was time to move on.
So did you go for, like, acting training, or did you just go right into auditions?
Kind of both. I realized quickly that I was never going to get a Casio commercial or a Dr. Pepper spot because I couldn't bring myself to say, when the lady comes in and goes, "You're the Pied Piper and everyone wants to be like you. Now let's get the next group in." And I was like, "Oh my God, I gotta go." No, you don't have to go. Come in here. We're doing the auditions. So I was like, "No, I swear to God, I don't know how to sell a little keyboard." Well, of course, now I would because I'm technically proficient. But I learned, you know that little movie out, Todd Graff's movie, Camp?
Oh, I love that film.
I went to Stage Door Manor.
Did you really?
Sure.
This is a summer camp for the performing arts.
Yes, in Loch Sheldrake it was initially, and Todd Graff and I were in, you know, plays and learned stuff. And
one of the funny things about camp, about the movie, is that they do these, like, overly sophisticated, ambitious, like Sondheim musicals. It's 12-year-olds. Were you in a position like that?
Join us now, we're on a marathon. Jacques Brel is alive and well, living in Paris. Jules Pfeiffer presents. I was like, who are all these people? It's like, shut up, Lyta Newport. Come here, kid. It was great. Never forget it. And then there was regional theater, and then there was off-Broadway and musicals. And so, you know, in my own way, you know, when I'm out west, you know, there's very few people who were afforded the kind of training I was. Like, what did you do? Well, I surfed, and I went to Baja, and I went to Club Med and got some drink beads, and then I, like, did a movie. You know, it's like I had it a little different than that.
Well, I really want to wish you good luck, and, you know, with your movies and with life and everything. And I really thank you for doing the interview. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, this was good.
Robert Downey Jr. talking with Terry Gross last year. His first CD as a singer-songwriter will be released next week. It's called The Futurist. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Light up your face with gladness. Hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear may be ever so near, that's the time. Still worthwhile if you just smile.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lord John and the Private Matter, the first Lord John Gray novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of Outlander. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the dreadfully sad. Filmmaker Guy Madden, his film The Saddest Music in the World is just out on DVD. And The Incurably Happy. Film critic David Edelstein reviews the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Guy Madden has been called the best filmmaker you've never heard of. Visually, Madden's work is inspired by silent films and German Expressionism. His movies include Tales from the Gimli Hospital and Dracula, Pages from a Virgin's Diary, a film adaptation of a ballet version of the Dracula story. Terry spoke with Guy Madden earlier this year about his latest movie, The Saddest Music in the World, which has just been released on DVD. It's a surrealistic comedy set during the Depression in Winnipeg, one of the coldest places in North America, which also happens to be the place where Guy Madden grew up and still makes his home. The film stars Isabella Rossellini as the owner of a beer brewery. She launches an international contest to find the saddest music in the world. Her life and the lives of all the main characters have been transformed by tragedy and grief. That may not sound very funny, but this is an odd film, inspired by Depression-era musicals, silent movies, and touches of Todd Browning's Freaks. Here's Rossellini in a scene from the film.
We at Musket Beer are proud that Winnipeg has been chosen 4 years in a row by the London Times as the world capital of sorrow in the Great Depression. In recognition of this honor, we will be hosting a worldwide contest to determine which nation's music truly deserves to be called the saddest in the world. Aspiring virtuosos of tearful melody are welcome to travel here and lay claim to the jewel-studded crown of frozen tears and $25,000. Prize money.
That's right. Guy Madden, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your movie, The Saddest Music in the World, is adapted from a screenplay that was written by Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote Remains of the Day. Right. But his screenplay was set in the 80s, and yours is set in the 1930s during the Depression. I think you probably reworked a lot of the original concept. Talk about your idea for what the contest would be like to find the saddest music in the world.
Well, the original premise of such a contest was Ish's, and he saw it as a political satire, mostly, about the way it's kind of sad that countries that are already suffering from the worst privations imaginable still have to pretend to be even worse off than they really are just to get some sort of international sympathy and charity, and that everyone is forced into this undignified limbo contest of exaggerating their misery to get some charity. And for me, the contest was a great backdrop for the way families and people in love manipulate each other in much the same way that countries do. And it was a great chance for me to have an orgy of self-pity, not just among nations, but among family members. You know the way families really mess with each other's minds. And so I just found sort of a microcosm within Ish's political satire. And my obsessions are always with family melodrama anyway. So it was just a matter of putting that peanut butter on Ish's chocolate and coming up with something that pleased us both.
Let's talk about the music a little bit. There actually is a contest in the movie for the saddest music in the world, and representatives from countries around the world show up to perform their music and vie for the cash reward.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about finding performers from around the world to use in this contest? Because you have real performers from different countries.
Yeah, most of them live in my hometown of Winnipeg.
Oh, really? I imagined you going around the world.
That's right. That's right, on a big talent
search. Putting classifieds in newspapers around the world.
That's right. Going to Moscow and
exactly.
Stockholm.
Scotland.
No, we just put an ad in the paper and actually dealt through the Winnipeg Folk Arts Council and just arranged for a massive audition. We just told various, El Salvadorian musicians, Portuguese fado musicians, Ukrainian bandurists to show up in costume with their instruments in full plumage and to play the two saddest songs they had in their repertoire. And we just invited them all to come up to this very tiny, crowded ballroom we rented in a hotel. They all had to ride up in an elevator, a very tiny elevator, so a big mariachi band would crowd out of the elevator while the Heather Bells, the all-female Highland bagpipe troupe, marched in. And it was great just to see the clash of colors, plaids, sombreros. It was really exciting, and I realized I kind of had half my musical problems solved right there at the audition. It was just a matter of picking my favorites from this and just getting a nice balance of colors and costumes and musics.
How did you explain yourself to them?
I kind of didn't, and that was kind of fun, just looking at the sheer puzzlement on their faces. And at one point in the auditions, I always encouraged the last group of musicians to stay on while the next one came on, and I would have them play at the same time and actually have them try to cross-pollinate or actually get down lower. I was thinking in terms of limbo, and I would tell the klezmer clarinetist to get down below the Ukrainian clarinetist and try to get down lower in pitch and lower in physicality and literally compete and cross swords with clarinets. And it was really kind of fun to watch these people literally competing for the tears of of the judges, me, my producers, musically, and it was all just sort of playing itself out the way it did in the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like a battle of the bands, except that they're all playing incredibly sad music.
Yeah, and it really was just like, I guess, just watching this self-pitying ants at a tea party just going at it and trying to top each other's stories of woe. I grew up in a family where people did that all the time, where Icelandic and all stories about our family are about tragedy and misery and, you know, plagues, blight, volcanic eruptions, etc.
Let me play the song I'd probably vote for if I were a judge in this contest for the saddest music in the world. And I'll just play an excerpt of this. This is a Mexican song, sung from the point of view of a mother who is singing to her dead baby. And as we hear the song, we'll also hear the announcers who are announcing this contest as it happens. And, of course, they're totally undercutting the tragedy with their absolutely clueless explanations of what's going on. So why don't we hear the scene?
Are giving us a sad peek into child burial customs down Mexico way.
The Mexican mama is being very firm with her dead infant. Now go away, she wails.
You are dead. Don't sneak in at night to nurse from my breast. That milk is only for the living.
To Canadian ears, that may sound harsh.
Well, I guess dead children, like any other kind, have got to learn.
It's a short scene from Guy Maddin's new film, The Saddest Music in the World. Guy, tell me.
That's I actually have a song, songwriting credit on that song, by the way.
Oh, did you co-write it?
I cannot read music, but I wrote the lyrics. I can't speak Spanish either, but I had the singer translated, and I just had to trust the translation.
What went through your mind as you were writing this? How did you come up with this idea of the woman singing to her dead child?
Well, there's nothing sadder than that, but you know, in spite of the recent epidemic of dead child movies that have been put out there, I find it extremely difficult to even approach the magnitude, the enormity of such a feeling. So it had, the only way to present it for me was to undercut it instantly somehow, and just to let off the clear message that I wasn't going to try to reach anybody's heart at that point. It was just had to be goofy.
Guy Maddin, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview, recorded earlier this year, with filmmaker Guy Madden. His latest movie, The Saddest Music in the World, has just been released on DVD.
Well, thinking back to the last interview that you did on Fresh Air after your ballet version of Dracula, and somehow we were talking about grief, which of course relates to this new movie, and you had mentioned that that your brother killed himself when he was 19, that he shot himself on the grave of his girlfriend.
Yeah, when I was 7, or just turning 7, I remember thinking it was quite thoughtless of him to do that just a week before my birthday. Yeah, it was, you know, obviously a horrible tragedy. It's the worst thing that can happen to parents. I was young enough that it was turned into a romance for me. The idea that he got to go to heaven with his girlfriend and that they were somehow being virtually married there, and that that our two families, the family of the dead girlfriend and my family, sort of considered each other in-laws as a way of making sense of this gesture of their sadnesses. It just seemed very romantic to me, the idea of, you know, very Wuthering Heights, you know, the idea of just giving your whole life for the love of somebody. And maybe that's what made me more receptive to romantic literature later, and I don't know, but it seems like the little garden from which I sprung was well watered with tears. It didn't. This isn't self-pity talking. It's something I just observed as a way of growing up. It didn't. Like I said, I couldn't have had a happier childhood. I loved it.
How did your brother's girlfriend die?
In a car accident. It was horrible. But and it just ruined him. You know, he hung in there for about 6 months and then couldn't take it anymore.
There's a car accident in this movie too.
Yeah, there is. Although the words "car accident" don't mean anything to me. They probably are horrible words to hear for the girl's family. But I don't know. All the trappings of that incident were as artificial as a TV show to me at that age. So I don't cringe or tweak when I hear those words.
It didn't scare you to death that your brother, in one gesture, was able to take his life away?
I don't know how to make sense of what I thought of it. I know I was given his bedroom the very night that he did it, and he had a way better bedroom than I did, and so I was, you know, I was pretty happy about that. I shared it with my other brother, who couldn't stand the sound of my night breathing. You know, it sort of haunted him a lot, and it might have. And I immediately thought I was him, and, you know, immediately started thinking about what it would be like to die or to kill myself, and, you know, in those ways that every child daydreams about, just wanting to go away when things don't go right, to remove yourself. But, I never really seriously considered it. It was just kind of a play daydream that I like to replay all the time.
I'm thinking back to something else you said in that first interview that we did. You said that when people who were important to you died, you felt you didn't grieve at the time, and that you even had to fake tears at their funeral. And I was thinking, you know, this just seems so connected to me, to this new movie, The Saddest Music in the World, because, you know, one of the characters just is incapable of grieving, and he kind of walks through life as if it were like a bleak comedy. And another character goes through life, because her grief is so deep, she falls into amnesia. Her only way of surviving is just totally to forget.
I guess you're very astute, Terry, because I think you have picked up on some kind of autobiographical trait that I've put in the movie, maybe without even thinking about it. I know when I was in my mid-teens, my father developed a very serious heart condition, and I just lived in terror of him just dropping dead of a heart attack. And the words "heart attack" literally launched me, whenever I happened to hear them on TV or in a conversation, would launch me into a procedure of elaborate superstitions, you know, crossing my fingers, knocking on wood, backing out of a room, left foot first, and all sorts of elaborate, strange, exhausting procedures. And I think when my father finally did have a heart attack and die, that or when he did die of some heart-related thing, that a fuse went in me, and I couldn't grieve. It was everything I'd feared and worse, because it really happened, and I just felt nothing. And I felt a bit ashamed of myself for not feeling anything, but I'm sure it's common that some people just can't feel anything. I guess it's just simply being in shock. Well, it didn't even feel like being in shock. I remember actually kind of enjoying all the company and sympathy I was getting around funeral time. It's pretty gloomy stuff we're talking about. But then I did grieve in the installment plan. For years, I was revisited by my father in regular dreams, just probably a pathological number of dreams. And so these characters, this woman who virtually is visited with amnesia when her child dies, is kind of just a version of that, I guess. It's just a matter of her being faced with something that's just unbearable, and amnesia is the only way to go. Amnesia and nymphomania, as it turns out.
That's right. She's got that, too.
That's two Band-Aids on top of a trauma.
Let me quote two things about sadness that are said in the movie. One is, what good is memory? Why make yourself sad? And the other is, sadness is just happiness turned on its ass. It's all showbiz.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sense of what sadness is. I know I don't like being sad very much, and the weirdest things make me sad. I don't know.
Like what?
Sometimes a movie that's mediocre for some reason. I like a really bad movie or a really good movie, but a movie that just somehow, there's a certain combination of notes that mediocrity combines to form and that just about has me suicidal. For some reason, the second Matrix movie had me on suicide alert. I had to make some hotline phone calls after walking out of that theater. I don't know.
Why? Because mediocrity wastes your time, or because there's something emotional in a mediocre film? Like, what is it?
Yeah, that one, I started daydreaming a bit about my brother, something I almost never do. And I know he was a bit of a science fiction enthusiast and kind of a technical freak. He built a stereo with his bare hands when he was 15 years old, and built a radio station and was arrested for broadcasting, from a pirate station when he was a young teen. And so I just started thinking of, I started daydreaming that I was watching this movie with him for some reason. This is something I've never done before. And then the movie was so overwhelmingly filled with effects that he would never have been able to comprehend at his young age. And then, but then it was so incomprehensibly boring at the same time that I remember just sort of thinking that maybe my brother would decide that he should have lived all along just because these movies are so cool and so technically slick, and the excitement of science would have made it worthwhile to keep on living. And then I realized I was losing him as the movie got worse and worse, and that by the end of the movie he was back in his grave and I was looking for one for myself. I don't know.
Gosh, this is what happens when your mind wanders when a movie's really dull.
Yeah, I probably should have just gone to see, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle again.
Was that better?
That was way better. I love that movie.
There's images of hockey in several of your films, and I know your father was the treasurer and manager of Canada's national hockey team.
Right.
You described yourself in our first interview as spending most of your childhood in front of the television with your dog. Did you play hockey too?
No, I didn't. And believe me, that was a source of unbelievable shame. Growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, father featured frequently in the city's newspaper, talking about Canada's national hockey team and not being able to skate. I don't know, I just spent too much time in front of the TV. Even my dog was stupid and a very, not even paper trained or anything. It was, we were both very underachieving organisms. And I finally couldn't stand the shame anymore. I bought a pair of skates when I was about 18 and just went out after dark and taught myself how to skate, and then just fell in love with it, became obsessed with it, dropped out of university and just spent all my time playing hockey with 12-year-olds. And until I was good enough to join a team. And I still have that kind of learned late skating style. I skate too straight up and down, and people know I was a late comer to the game. But it's just every stride I take on the ice feels like I'm undoing the shame of my childhood. And I'm not quite done yet. I'm still playing. I'm 48 years old now, and I still play. And I'm not kidding. Every stride I take feels like I'm repairing damage.
Too bad your dog didn't live long enough to undo his reputation.
Yeah, no, my dog lived a pure life, underachieving to the end. It didn't even get out of bed to die. Died on my feet while I was sleeping.
Well, Guy Madden, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks so much, Terry.
Guy Madden speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. His film, The Saddest Music in the World, has just been released on DVD. Coming up, a much happier and more absorbent movie subject, SpongeBob SquarePants. This is Fresh Air. A movie based on the very popular cartoon show SpongeBob SquarePants opens today across the country. The optimistic Sponge has charmed children, their parents, and grown-ups who don't even have little kids. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Many of us suffer through insipid kid shows for the sake of keeping our young'uns company, partly to monitor what they watch, partly in the hope that an occasional parental interjection like, "Now why would he want to do that?" will break the trance state before they become entirely passive zombie-like receptacles. We've come to look on Steven Hillenburg's SpongeBob SquarePants as a gift, a joyful spasm of whacked-out surrealism featuring one of the sweetest characters in cartoondom. This kitchen sponge-shaped sea sponge with two widely spaced front teeth and a laugh like a dolphin on a sugar high is TV's most happy-go-lucky optimist, a child man who takes joy in even a minimum wage, dead-end, fast food job, at the bottom of the ocean, no less. Each episode is nautical whimsy bordering on nonsense, with ukulele music and flower cloud backdrops. It's old-fashioned squash and stretch animation wedded to a slacker stoner worldview. And at 11 short minutes, the length of a SpongeBob cartoon, it's just about perfection. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie is quite a bit longer than 11 minutes. It's not a padded-out short. The film tells a classic story with a classic screenplay structure. To save SpongeBob's boss at the Krusty Krab, Mr. Krabs, from execution, SpongeBob and his imbecilic purple starfish pal Patrick embark on a heroic quest to recover the crown of King Neptune, the tyrannical ruler of Bikini Bottom. Who framed Mr. Krabs? Why, that insanely jealous, one-eyed proprietor of the rival restaurant, the Chum Bucket, Plankton. Here's the first encounter between the tiny, gloating protozoan and our porous yellow hero on his way to the opening of the Krusty Krab 2, which SpongeBob is sure he'll be appointed to manage. He's so ebullient, he doesn't even realize where he's stepping or whom he's scraping off the bottom of his shoe.
Enjoy today, Mr. Krabs, because by tomorrow I'll have the formula. Then everyone will eat at the Chum Bucket, and I will rule the world! All hail Plankton! All hail Plankton!
I'm ready. Promotion. I'm ready. Promotion.
Phew, I think I stepped in something.
Not in something, on someone, you twit!
Oh, sorry, Plankton. Are you on your way to the grand opening ceremony?
No, I am not on my way over to the grand opening ceremony. I'm busy planning to rule the world!
Well, good luck with that. I'm ready. Promotion.
That's Tom Kenny as SpongeBob, using a Pee-wee Herman on helium vocal attack, but making it brilliantly his own. Well, good luck with that, says SpongeBob, proving he doesn't even comprehend evil. It's a measure of his decency that he'd risk his life for Mr. Krabs after being passed over for manager and after a post-heartbreak ice cream bender that leaves him a red-eyed wreck. All this is amusing enough, but I kept waiting for the story to zigzag and go hurtling off into the furthest reaches of absurdity. It does, sort of, finally, but the path is pretty straight, or as they say in the screenplay biz, linear. King Neptune, voiced by Jeffrey Tambor, is a dull despot, imported from a more conventional cartoon universe, and his friendly daughter, a bespectacled mermaid named Mindy, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, is only mildly more diverting, largely thanks to Patrick's habit of drooling and babbling, "She's hot," whenever she's in the vicinity. Things pick up when SpongeBob and Patrick, mistakenly convinced of their invincibility, do a nonchalant soft shoe slap and tickle in the midst of an abyss as sundry humongous tentacled creatures prepare to eat them. And there are two amazing live-action encounters, one with a friendly David Hasselhoff, the other an unfriendly Cyclops, actually a deep-sea diver fond of drying out sea creatures and turning them into kitschy knickknacks. Here, Hillenburg and his animators subject us to the horrifying spectacle of SpongeBob and Patrick drying out into a real kitchen sponge and a dead starfish. It's enough to make you pray to be back in the cartoon universe, which you are pretty fast, thank heaven. There's plenty to treasure in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, but for all the spit and polish animation and the rollicking soundtrack, this isn't the Yellow One's finest hour. I know Hillenburg didn't want to make a SpongeBob episode stretched out. He wanted a movie with a beginning, middle, end, and a stirring inspirational message. But I like my SpongeBob fleeter, more bubbly, without that big, heavy anchor of a plot to weigh him down.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez-Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, go SpongeBob.
Hooray! Now that they're men, you can't bother them. Now that they're men, they have become our friends. Now that they're men, they'll be a happy end. They'll pass the test and finish the quest for the crown. They'll pass the test and finish the quest. They'll pass the test and finish the quest for the crown.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Neighborhood Starbucks, collecting books and toys for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Blues Brother, Conehead, Ghostbuster, and all-around wild and crazy guy, Dan Aykroyd. He's got a new book in which his Blues Brothers alter ego, Elwood, interviews legends of the blues. Join us for the next Fresh Air.